Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you're the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing really well.
Oh, you got a big smile on your face over there.
I know. We're just about to start a summer series.
Summer series.
A five-day summer blast of...
Vacations gone wrong.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mostly camping. So no one should camp.
Yeah. So you ready to start?
Camping nightmares. The five camping nightmares of summer.
Camp Crystal Cam. See what I did there. Just kidding. All right, you ready?
Mm-hmm. I'm ready. Let's go.
If you know me, you know I'm kind of a tomboy, right? Mm-hmm. I like to go camping, get my hands dirty, go fishing. But I also really like lipstick and makeup and being a girl. One of my biggest fears, and I've had this forever, and I don't even know where it comes from,
Woody is Woodpecker.
The fear of bears.
Yes. That's a good fear to have.
If I'm stressed out in my life, I dream about bears, mm-hmm. always.
Now, you know what I dream about when I stress out? My old job.
So in my dreams, usually it's a grizzly bear, mm-hmm. but I've had some nighttime tryst with black bears and brown bears. Every once in a while, even a polar bear might appear, but usually it's a giant grizzly or even five chasing me in my dreams. Now, it's funny because we all know that I don't run, so I would obviously make a nice little midnight snack for mm-hmm. the bear, and the bear would have little to no effort to catch me.
You can climb a tree. Grizzlies can't climb trees.
So the whole point to all of this, Jen, mm-hmm. is that when I go camping, I worry about bears breaking in.
Yeah.
When we arrive at a campsite, I usually take a look around the campground, and I try to think, hey, if I were a bear, which campsite would be the hardest to get to? And then I pick that one out. And
the ones in the tree.
Literally, I'm not kidding. What I don't fear is being murdered by a lunatic while camping.
Only a bear. But after today, we might feel differently.
Well, until now, that is.
Yeah.
Thank you. This case is tragic and senseless, much like they all are. It's one that I remember seeing when I was young, like one of the FBI files or forensic files, one of those old shows that came on, you know,
right.
cable TV was hitting and all that.
Mm-hmm. Back in the 80s.
But this case is also historic in the sense that it was one of the very first cases to use criminal profiling.
Mm. With John Douglas?
One of his counterparts.
Okay.
Which you may or may not know the name. I did. You probably will. But here we go. You ready?
I am.
Camping is a family tradition that goes way back. It's a cheap way to bond, see the country. And that is just what the Yeager family wanted to do when they set off to Montana from Michigan. Jim Yeager, who worked at an auto plant, took an entire month off to be with his family out crisscrossing the states and heading west. Marietta Yeager was excited to share this journey with her young family, as well as her parents who joined them on this big trip.
It's a lot of people going.
It was Sunday, June 24th, and they were spending their last night in Montana's Headwaters State Park. The eldest son slept in the van, while the youngest four Yeagers all slept in their very own tent.
Aww.
Marietta and Jim hugged and kissed all their children goodnight, excited to start on their next big adventure tomorrow. The couple then retired to a camper truck parked at the site. It was around 4 a.m. when 13-year-old Heidi Yeager woke up to some chilly air hitting her. There was a hole in the tent, a big hole. Heidi felt around the sleeping bag for her 7-year-old sister, Susie, who was sleeping in that spot. But it was only a sleeping bag. Heidi, scared, gets up and runs to wake up her parents and tell them that Susie was not in the tent. Marietta and Jim wake and immediately think, well, she's just gone to the bathroom. get a drink. No. You know, they think that obviously there has to be an explanation. That thought fades as they arrive and see that the tent had been sliced open. The fear deepens as they see Susie's stuffed animals that she always sleeps with lying on the ground outside of the tent. Jim Yeager jumps in the car and goes to call police. Remember, no cell phones back then. Police think that, oh, this is easy. It's going to turn out to be nothing since, you know, there's no crime in this area. Surely, little Susie is totally fine. Upon arriving, they inspect the tent, and now they know something sinister has occurred. Nearby, the detective sees a clear set of footprints leading to a parking lot, but there were no cars in that lot. The Gallatin County Sheriff's Office now know that this little girl is missing, and time is of the essence, so they immediately notify the FBI, as often kidnapping cases take place and cross state lines.
Mm-hmm.
FBI agent Pete Dunbar is assigned to the case, along with Special Agent William Terry. They leave to go to the campground. Upon arriving, it's clear that little Susie Yeager was stolen out of the tent as she slept. How terrible is that?
Awful.
And you don't think that?
No.
Like maybe attacking you in the tent, but not cutting you out the side.
Mm-mm.
Authorities from all over would lend in the search, covering all the angles. Helicopters in the air, canines on the ground. It would turn out to be one of the largest manhunts in Montana history.
Well, there's not a lot of people in Montana, so.
And lots of land to cover.
Exactly.
The investigators start their search from the Yeager campsite and make their way out, expanding as they go. Detectives that were on scene working to find Susie were disturbed by this kidnapping, as it was not the first time that they had been at this exact camping area investigating a similar crime. It was May 5th, 1968, when a Boy Scout camping trip would have a terrifying ending. A Boy Scout woke up in the morning and started to rustle his bunk mate to wake up. When not getting a response of any kind, the young boy began to shake his body with his hand, and while doing so, his hand became covered in wetness. It was blood.
No.
Sometime during the night, while sleeping, the 12-year-old had been beaten and stabbed. His lung was punctured, and he had severe head trauma. He made it out of the campsite, but sadly passed away the following day. No one was ever charged in the beating death of this young Boy Scout, and police are starting to fear that maybe that assailant had returned and this time took Susie Yeager. The police began canvassing the area, knocking on all doors. Some people that floated to the top of the suspect pool were those that had had past issues with the law and involving children. If these people were unable to provide an alibi as to where they were and what they were doing that night that Susie disappeared, they were asked to come in and take a lie detector exam. While one suspect seemed promising, his whereabouts were corroborated by people who saw him that evening. Investigators are beginning to lose hope of a quick arrest as time is passing, and they worry that Susie being found alive is not going to happen. Tips were coming in from all over the state. A tip came in to police suggesting they look into this man's 25-year-old neighbor, because he was a bit odd. When the deputies arrive, they know the man. He's a local contractor, and nothing jumped out at them as suspicious. He even offered to help them if they needed it. They say thank you. They depart.
It's always the helpful ones, isn't it?
A week later, a phone call comes into a Gallatin deputy's house, and his wife answers the phone. The man on the other end of the line claimed to be Susie's kidnapper. He demanded money be sent to a bus station in Denver. To prove he had Susie, he told the deputy's wife about Susie's index finger. It seems Susie's nails were slightly deformed. They kind of like formed in a little hump, both of them.
Mm.
Only somebody that knew Susie or had Susie would know about her fingers.
Mm-hmm.
So they immediately thought that this was legitimate. The FBI informed the Yeagers about the ransom call, and the family confirmed that Susie's fingers were, in fact, mildly deformed. Agents were desperate for the caller to call again, as they believed he was, in fact, the person that held young Susie. But that call didn't come. Investigators continued desperately looking for Susie. And all that time, Marietta and Jim were right there, never giving up hope that Susie would be returned unharmed.
You couldn't ever give up hope. ever. It's the only thing we have left.
They're on site, though. You know what I mean? Like, they're still at the camping site. I can't even imagine.
I would never go home.
This whole...
Until she was found, I couldn't.
Bothered me so bad. A month had now passed since Susie disappeared, and sadly, Jim needed to return to work. It was a painful decision, but they needed to leave the campsite and hope that the investigators would continue working hard to locate their missing baby. The family left for Michigan, with the piece of them left behind, but never forgotten. Authorities were working around the clock trying to find the person who took little Susie. FBI agents went ahead and were waiting at the Detroit home to assure the Yeagers that they would be there and continue to work with Montana authorities to find the person who did this to their daughter. Little did they know, the kidnapper was keeping an eye on the Yeager family. At this point in time, investigators believe Susie had been murdered, but her parents didn't want to entertain that as a possibility. Their hope was that since the kidnapper reached out once, that he may try to do it again, but they needed to be ready for it. The FBI put a device on the Yeager family house phone with the hopes of tracking all incoming and outgoing phone calls. The community rallied about the family. They lent their assistance. They posted flyers all around. They even mailed flyers to all the police agencies in and around Montana. The Yeagers, especially Marietta, would not give up hope on Susie. She stayed home all the time, afraid she might miss a phone call or receive information and not be there to get it. In fact, she only left the house once, and it was not by her choice. Her son was supposed to catch a ride home with a friend, and that ride failed to show up and get him. She jumped in the car to pick him up and was gone for less than 10 minutes.
And that's when he called.
The phone rang, and Dan Yeager, their oldest son, picked up the phone. It was the kidnapper.
Of course.
Thankfully, Dan, as well as the rest of the members in the house, were given a lesson and protocol on what to do should the kidnapper ever call and they receive the phone call. The man asked Dan, "Would you like to know where Susie is?" Dan asked the man to release his sister. The man then mentioned that he was not happy that the police and FBI were involved, and because of this, he couldn't release Susie without getting caught, and then hung up. Seconds later, Marietta comes home, and she immediately knew what happened. She could just tell by the look on her son's face, like the look of shock. The call was tapped, and it was traced to a diner in Wyoming. But when the officers arrived, the caller is long gone.
Of course.
Authorities, believing that Susie had been dead for a while at this point, believe that the man is getting a thrill out of reaching out to the family. He's torturing them, you know, making them relive this. 8 months pass since Susie's abduction, when a call comes in about a 19-year-old woman who had disappeared from Manhattan, Montana, which was about 10 miles from the campground. Sandra Smalligan's mother told police that her daughter was last seen on February 9th, returning to her apartment about midnight after she had been out with friends. Sandra's car was missing and no one had heard from her in days. A missing persons case was opened and Deputy Don Houghton, still working the Yeager kidnapping, was assigned to the case. This is where small little things fall in place. You know what I'm saying?
It only takes one thing to make everything fall like dominoes.
Deputy Howden was cruising the rural roads looking for Sandra's car or any evidence, signs of her, you know, anything that he would think was not quite right in the middle of this desolate area. He saw something. Something kind of flickered, and he knew it wasn't quite right, so he got out of his patrol car to take a look. It was a pair of women's panties.
Women's?
Women's panties. Little underwears.
Huh.
Near,
not children.
No.
Women's.
Women's. This is like in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
Right. Nearby was an old barn, and Howden wanted to get inside. He needed to get in there. He just wanted to take a look around. He gets over to the door, and it's locked. It's an old barn, old wood. He busts it open quite easily. Goes inside. He's looking around. Not really noticing anything too odd, he sees a large blue tarp that seems to be covering a car. And he goes over and he lifts up the edge of it. It doesn't have any license plates on it. The license plates have been removed, which is, you know, that's okay. Then he stood back and he realized he recognized the car immediately. This was a small town. It was Sandra Smalligan's car. Deputies and volunteers searched the area around the barn, covering an approximate 5-mile area, marking anything off as they walked and thought it would be important. They did the line search, you know, where you stand in the line and go. What one such find was a 55-gallon drum, which contained some charred wood. They go and they kind of look at it, move some stuff around, and they notice some fragments, some bone fragments. Now, they're starting to get nervous. There is some bone fragments in with this charred wood, and it had been burned relatively recently. So now, kind of thinking that they have something to look for, they now venture out, and they realize what they were missing the first time as they were going through. Scattered over a 75-yard area in mostly tiny, small pieces are more than 1,200 bone fragments.
Oh.
It was confirmed to belong to Sandra Smalligan, as they were able to identify her by a few of the teeth they had found. Authorities are now worried that whoever killed Sandra might have taken Susie. As the officers working both the cases would often meet at a diner in town for lunch and talk about the cases, discuss the two that they're working on.
Right.
As is the case in many of these small towns, everybody knows each other and they know what's going on at all times.
And as we know.
One resident would often pull up a chair and sit down with the police, and he'd ask about how the cases were going. This man was named David Mayerhofer. David was a local contractor, and if you remember, he was questioned early on because his neighbor said he acted odd. Now, you and I, as internet detectives, what do we know about those people that interject themselves into the investigation and ask a lot of questions and offer help?
They are probably the ones that did the crime in the first time.
Little question mark over them, right? Agent Dunbar recalls that David was very familiar with the area in which Sandra Smalligan was discovered. Oh, and he dated her for a short time.
Oh, really?
David now comes back into play as a suspect.
Couldn't let go, huh?
David Mayerhofer comes into the station and agrees to take a polygraph exam. During the questioning, David denies knowing anything about Susie's disappearance or Sandra's murder. He does acknowledge going out with Sandra, but only once, as she didn't want to see him again. The examiner determined that there was no sign of deception in the test. Police then ask him to submit to questioning under sodium amytal. Do you know what that is?
It's truth serum.
I know. That is so fascinating, I think. He consents, and under the drug, David Mayerhofer calmly answers all the questions, never once contradicting what he had said previously to police.
He's gotten his story straight then.
So do you know how sodium amytal works, by the way? Because I had to look all this up. Wasn't interesting?
No, I don't, actually.
It's a barbiturate that relaxes the person so much so that it lulls them into a state to where they can't really lie. They struggle to lie. So I'm guessing it's sort of like being drunk or something. You know what I mean? Where you can't rein it in.
You're not thinking, not thinking straight.
The investigators are back to square one, and the case stalls until 1974 when Agent Dunbar meets Special Agent Patrick Mullaney. Mullaney was heading up a new area in the police investigation department called profiling. Now, profiling, as we know, is a science in which a character sketch is made of the perpetrator based on how the crime was committed and what kind of person that they believe would do that. Mullaney asked for the files in the Yeager case. He wants to go over every single thing that the police had done in the case, from crime scene photos to interviews. He wants it all, nothing left out. It took several days to go through, but a picture was finally emerging for Agent Mullaney. According to the profilers, the nature of the crime and the way Susie was watched and how she was taken indicated that the person had to have had some military training or background. The person would have to be physically strong enough to carry a 55-pound child out of a tent and the area, all while trying to keep her quiet, and she may be struggling.
In a wooded area, so that would be...
They believe the person to be a loner, possibly with mental health issues such as schizophrenia, and this person would have trouble with the opposite sex. They also believe this person was the type that would want to relive and revisit the memory of his crime. He would keep a trophy, which could be anything from an earring to a body part. It was gruesome, but now in 2019, we know that happens way more than we'd like to think.
And you would think that profile would fit almost every killer, too.
Back then,
you know?
It was such a shocker, though. You know what I mean? Ooh. One suspect jumped out at Mullaney and his team, and that was David Mayerhofer.
Dude.
Police agencies, as well as some of the fellow FBI, were not buying this at first. They believed that David had been questioned and was open and willing to help authorities. David Meerhofer had even passed those truth exams, the polygraph and the truth serum.
But if you're psycho.
But the one thing they didn't understand yet was that a schizophrenic can disassociate from reality so much so that they could tell a huge lie and never even raise their heartbeat. Right. Again, the profiling, not that new, you know what I mean? The profiling team made one last prediction. Believing to know this person and believing that they would be able to guess what would come into play with this type of perpetrator, profilers said that the killer would phone Marietta Yeager on the first anniversary of Susie's disappearance. As the 1 year was approaching, media started reaching out to Marietta Yeager in the hopes of getting an interview. Yeager, hoping to keep the heat on the person who did this to her sweet little daughter, as well as help keep Susie's name out there and on everybody's mind, she agrees to sit down with the reporter. When the reporter asked Marietta what she would want to say to the person who did this, Marietta, always graceful, said she'd like to talk to the kidnapper to know why he did this and that her religious faith let her feel sorry for him.
Yeah, I don't know if I could do that.
She's a better person than I am. On June 24th, 1974, 1 year after Susie was stolen, at 3:30 a.m., the phone rang.
Exact time and everything.
Marietta raced to the phone and the recorder. She picked up the phone knowing who it would be. When the man said, "Is this Susie's mom?" the doubt was gone. The man continued, "This is the man who took Susie from you 1 year ago to the minute." Marietta began immediately pleading for Susie to come home. The phone goes dead. The Yeagers are in shock, desperate, and still with no answers. They sit in silence until a ringing phone breaks that silence only moments later. He called back.
"You're kidding me."
A calm came over Marietta as she wanted to keep him on the phone and to get him talking about what happened exactly 1 year ago. Marietta knew she would have to let him have control since that is what he so desperately needed.
Very good, Marietta.
The man tells Marietta that he still has Susie and she's fine. The two of them have been having a great time traveling all over the places and going to such fun destinations. He told Marietta, "Don't worry about her. In fact, she's asleep right here in the cabin." He also stated he was too smart to be caught.
That's the downfall right there.
Meanwhile, Jim Yeager had contacted the FBI, and they were tracing the phone call and its location. Marietta knew she had to keep him talking to give the FBI a chance to get to him. She decided to take it up a notch. Marietta told the man she was praying for him and that she felt sorry for him. She maintained composure and control. She was starting to throw the kidnapper off. She was able to keep him on the phone for over an hour.
You're kidding me.
Over an hour of speaking to the man who abducted and most likely murdered your 7-year-old baby girl.
I would have lost it on him. I don't know if I could have done that.
What she was saying to him was getting to him. When he did finally hang up, he was sobbing out of control and crying.
Well, good.
Since this was 1974, technology was shoddy at best. And with a heavy heart, the agents told the Yeagers that the trace had failed. The family was devastated, thinking they were so close. And what if, just what if Susie was sleeping in a cabin? And would they lose her forever? A month later, a rancher in Montana contacts police about a phone call made from his line, his house, calling a number in Michigan. And he did not make that phone call. The call, turned out, was placed to the Yeager house. The rancher, while ranching and traveling out on his property, noticed some tire tracks under a telephone pole on his property. The tires were not his nor anyone he knew. Police asked the rancher for names of people who were familiar with the ranch, who would know to get to that telephone pole in the middle of a field.
Of nowhere, yeah.
The rancher said that there was a man, in fact, who used to work for him, and he would know all the ins and outs of the ranch. That man, David Meerhofer. And the job that David did in the Marines? He was a communications specialist with the knowledge of how to tap directly into a line via the telephone pole. Investigators have a name, but they need more. Profiling would not be the only new tool police would use in this case. Agents would use something called voice print analysis. Scientists had begun to study people's voices using a sound spectrograph. People's voices, apparently, are unique to them based on their physical makeup. The specialist compared the one-year anniversary call from David to the Yeagers and compared it to an interview that David had done. It came back. It was confirmed. It was the same person.
Great.
Agent Dunbar goes to David's house and informs him that they believe he was the one that made the one-year anniversary call to the Yeagers. David, of course, says, well, I have lots of relatives who sound just like me.
Oh, yeah.
Police put together a voice lineup consisting of those relatives as well as David. Investigators take the lineup to the actual ranch. They wanted it to be most like that area and anything that would change the call. The investigators then call the Yeagers at home, and Marietta gets on the phone.
Boy, she's brave.
Each man was given a number. Hi, I'm number one, right? And then they were given a phrase, which the kidnapper had used in that phone call to the Yeagers. The officers then had Marietta take the phone and listen to these men as they gave the speech. The voice hit Marietta immediately, and she knew for certain which voice belonged to David.
Wow.
It was number two. While compelling, investigators still needed more. They needed a confession. And how would a person like him, psychological makeup, most likely confess? They had to instigate a confrontation between Marietta, Susie's mom, and David, Susie's kidnapper. It was more than a difficult task, but one that Marietta welcomed. She wanted to not only meet the man who took her baby away from her that chilly Montana night, she wanted to look him in the eye and say that she had forgiven him. Let me just say here, she is a much better person than I could ever be, because let me tell you what, if I saw the man who I thought took my child, one of us would not be leaving.
Yeah.
And either he or I would be dying. I'm telling you.
Oh, yeah.
To be able to forgive this man and be strong enough to not only go on after this happened in your life, but to forgive, like, unbelievable.
No.
On September 12th, 1974, Marietta Yeager enters a lawyer's office, but not any law office. It is the suite of the lawyer who is representing David Meerhofer. Both the attorney and David are there to meet with Susie's mom. As they take their seats around the room, Marietta jumps right in and says she knows he is the man who took Susie. David immediately denies it and says she's wrong. Not deterred, she does not back down. The conversation goes on for over an hour, and David never confesses.
Mm-mm.
Finally, the attorney says, that's all there is, and we're going to end it right now. Marietta finally watched as the man she believes took her daughter walk out the door. She is sure more than ever that he did, in fact, take Susie. Police decide to keep the pressure on and set up round-the-clock surveillance, but they want him to know he's being watched, so they're totally awkwardly obvious in doing it.
Mm-hmm.
They want him to stress. They want him to make a mistake. On September 24th, David slips away. The officers who were watching him in the house started to realize they saw him come home the night before, but it's now the next day and they haven't seen him. So they go up, knock on the front door, and no one answers. They go ahead and get inside and they realize David is gone. They panic. Officers search everywhere. They disperse out and start hitting all the spots that David was known to frequent, his workplace, everywhere. He's nowhere to be found. While police are out looking for David, a phone call comes into the Yeager home. It was 1 year to the day that the kidnapper had last called the residence, that very first time when Marietta was out picking up her son.
Mm-hmm.
This guy liked anniversaries.
Oh, obvious. Yeah.
This time, the caller identified himself as Mr. Travis. But Marietta knew it was the same voice. It was David. The caller told her that David was not the kidnapper.
Oh.
And instead, it was he, Mr. Travis. And Mr. Travis was from Salt Lake City. Mr. Travis, David, says, I can prove that Susie's alive. Here, I'll put her on the phone. A little girl's voice comes on and tells Marietta, he's a nice man, Mommy. We have been going lots of places. There's only one problem.
It's not Susie.
Susie never called her mother Mommy. She only ever called her Mama. So Marietta knew immediately that was not Susie.
Just like Eleven from Stranger Things. Mama. I went to see Mama.
Marietta kept him on the phone, refusing to call him Mr. Travis, and would only call him David.
Good.
He was becoming irate, and the pressure was starting to get to him. The man blurted out some things that only David would know, because it was David who said those things to Marietta when they were in that law office.
Right.
David realized what he had done, and that was he incriminated himself. Angry, David screamed, "You will never see your little girl again," and he slammed the phone down. Police tracked the call to a Salt Lake City hotel room, but by the time they arrived, he was gone. Investigators were panicked. Did he take another child? Was that who was on the phone? Right. Did he steal another little girl and was about to do the same thing that he had done to Susie? When David comes back to town, they're waiting for him. They arrest him and find a piece of hotel stationery on his person from a hotel in Salt Lake City. And there was something written on it.
Marietta's phone number.
Close. The name Travis.
Oh, okay.
A search warrant is issued and the team goes into the house to search it. While inside, the officers make a grisly discovery. Deep inside David's kitchen freezer, wrapped in butcher paper, marked with the letters S period M period S period. An officer takes one of the packages and slowly unwraps it.
No.
Inside is a human hand with two severed fingers inside the palm. They now know these are the body parts of Sandra Marie Smalligan. And these were David's trophies. Detectives meet with David's attorney, who has a statement for them, and it is one that will knock the wind out of them. David has agreed to confess. Confess to four murders.
Four?
Police turn on the tape recorder, and they sit back to hear what David has to say. David tells them he was only a senior in high school when he committed his first murder back in 1967. He tells authorities that a classmate of his had picked a fight with him, and it left him very angry and embarrassed. So one day, when he was out and about, he saw that classmate's little brother out fishing with a friend. He took aim and shot the boy as an act of revenge against the brother.
Nice ego. Yeah.
David then tells the officers that his second murder was the one he committed in 1968. He tells them that he snuck into the Headwaters campground and attacked a Boy Scout in his tent. He was mad at the local troop who had kicked him out, and he wanted to embarrass them. His third victim was Susie Yeager. He tells them he was waiting until he thought all of them were good and asleep, and he quietly cut the side of the tent in a hole just big enough to get little Susie out of. He then took her to the Horseshoe Hills Ranch. He strangled her and dismembered her body and scattered her all around. This was the ranch where Sandra Smalligan was discovered. Apparently, after Sandra had refused to see David again, he broke into her place late one night and was planning to abduct her. He placed a piece of duct tape on her mouth, but without knowing it, the tape covered her nose, too. He was busy packing some clothes of hers to take because, you know, he was going to keep her for a while. And when he had realized what he had done, it was too late. Sandra was no longer breathing. She had suffocated. He would have killed her.
He would have, yeah. But still, what a way to go.
He took Sandra's body back to the ranch, in which he dismembered her body and put it into a 55-gallon barrel and burnt it up along with some wood and shingles. He then spread what was left over all over the ranch, just as he did with Susie's body. It was what the authorities had suspected all along, but now they had the confession. As part of the deal, they promised not to seek the death penalty, but would go instead for life in prison, where David would spend the remaining days of his life in a concrete cell. Unfortunately, for the loved ones who wanted to address David in court, they would never get the chance. Only hours after his confession, four-time murderer David Meyerhofer, while using prison towels, hanged himself in prison.
Wow.
He's a jerk!
You think?
Yes. That case bothered me so, because like camping, and you know I'm a big chicken, and I remember being so young, and I want to say it was probably like 1991, so what were we, 18-ish? Okay, 20.
One.
Okay, 21, whatever. I remember watching that, and that just stuck with me, because I'm like, I would always think about bears and things like that, but not that.
No, killing kids and...
Abducting people. Them. And I'm thinking, like, so all of this had me going, and I'm like, okay, what kind of tent would that be? Because, like, today they have that really thin, satiny material for tents. But back then, when we were young, that was that really heavy canvas. And if you touched it, it would leak. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking, that had to be the heavy canvas back in the early 70s. Four kids in there. None of them wake up with the knife
going. You know how.
They sleep like a rock. Yeah. And they play so heavy during the day.
Right. When they're exhausted, they don't wake up. Like when my kids were little, you could take them and do.
Yeah.
Put them in any room. take him out of the car, put him in
That's
the car.
That's what I was thinking. Like, when they wouldn't even know. She was probably asleep and just thought it was her dad or something.
It was just recently until my youngest always thought she sleepwalked because she would she goes, I'd go to sleep on the couch and then I'd have to sleepwalk and I'd be in my bedroom. And I'm like, no, that was your dad. Your dad carried you to your room.
That's funny.
Yeah.
All right, John, that's all I got.
Yeah, that's
it's terrible.
Poor Susie. I bet people
have known that. But I was familiar. Like I said, I watched that a long time ago. And that always stuck with me. But I did not realize he had murdered other people.
Yeah, I know the story of Susie, but I didn't know he'd murdered other people either.
All right, you want to tell the good people where they can find us?
Twitter, our True Crime Pod. We have a blog, ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Leave us a nice little 5-star review on Apple, if you could, on iTunes. We're on Facebook. We've got a discussion page.
Hit us up.
You can buy merch at our Etsy store. And if you don't want to sign up for Patreon, but you would like to maybe just slip us a little cash, a little something, something, you can go to our blog at ourtruecrimepodcast.com and there's a donate button. But like I said, it's no biggie.
Or you can just donate a lot of money to me. I'll give you my personal address and you can send it to me.
Or you could do a drug deposit too. That's fine.
Just a drug deposit?
Direct deposit.
I thought you said direct deposit.
Just go ahead and give us an email and we'll get y'all the numbers.
All right. So remember, lock your doors.
Keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love you.
Dream the other day. I totally forgot to tell you. A math dream.
That's a stress dream.
It was terrible. Oh my God. And it was a new form of math called like geotrigonometry or something in my head. And I was like, are you kidding
me? Could you
even
spell that?
No.
No. Yeah.
Okay. My punchline. Hi, Nika.
Sorry, Nika.
It's Jennifer just doing her stuff. Yeah, it's all about her.
I'm trying to get my phone's about to die.
No, I can't have that app.
Well, I'm waiting for the beauty shop to call about Reggie.
Beauty shop dropout. Okay. This case is tragic and senseless, much like they all are. It's
much
one
like your hair today. Sorry, I had to put that in notes.
I'm on summer break. You're lucky I shower.
I think your hair looks really cute, by the way.
What?
I just had to get that
hair.
In.
Whatever.
I just wanted to
I
get that
deodorant
in.
On.
Hey,
what else do you want?
That's a plus.
Okay, hold on, Nico.
So
pause
don't
it. So
ask
you don't
me,
have
Dave.
To do that.
Why do you drink, Hank? Why do you roll smoke?
It's Jaeger, right?
Why must you live out the song that you wrote? Stop and think it over. Try to put yourself in my unique position.
Jaeger.
Because I get stoned and sing all night long.
Okay, sorry about that. Here we go.
Family tradition. If I drink too much, like if you
Jennifer, you have a big mouth all the time. Are you kidding me?
I know, but I...
Hi, Nico. Can I ask you a question? Do you have a girlfriend? Oh my God, you
I'm
did
nosy.
Not. You are nosy. Okay, back to me. Here's okay.
Yahoo! Let's celebrate. There's a party going on right here. Celebration to last throughout the year. So bring your good times and your laughter too. We gon' celebrate your party with you. Come on
it's
now.
It's Mulaney. Mulaney. That's another freaking... I didn't even spell that right. The right time.
Anytime.